record, and I do believe we're ready to do this.
Good stuff.
Excellent. So, take it away, Simon.
Hello, I'm Simon Mercer. This is Crave, the podcast dedicated to film, music, theatre, television, anything that's been entertaining Steve McCabe and I lately.
Now, here at Crave, we take a very broad view of the word entertainment, which is why, Simon, where exactly are you right now?
Well, I've actually just got back, would you believe? I was just a matter of hours ago in a small New Zealand town you may or may not have heard of called Whangamataa, surrounded by classic cars, caravans, motorbikes, and rock and roll revival bands.
May have heard, I've been through it all, haven't I? I've been here for years. I'm not quite as much of a newcomer as you think I am.
Okay, yeah, so you have been to the east coast of the Coromandel Peninsula.
There you go, yes. Passed through it, lovely place.
Good, so it is. And that event is something called the Beach Hop. It's an annual do that's been going for several years. More Mustangs, Chevrolets and Pontiacs you can throw a stick at. I'll tell you a little bit about that later, and I've got some lovely photos of said vehicles, and I'll put those on our website. You can catch them a bit later on.
Sounds like a plan to me.
Good stuff. What about the cinema, Steve?
Well, we'll start off as usual with our usual cinematic temptations. And we've got, I think, like a very contrasting pair of films to open with this week, haven't we?
Certainly have, and then some.
Yeah, we'll start with the big name, the much touted, much vaunted, much hyped, and much, well, there's all manner of adjectives you could supply here, isn't there? Batman versus Superman, Yawn of Justice.
yes, well, we may be sharing some views on that one, I suspect. I have also been to see the new New Zealand film that a lot of people are talking about. This is the one by Taika Waititi, he of Boy fame. This one, another comedy, Hunt for the Wilder People.
Yes.
Lovely.
Now, I didn't get to see this one, but I gather that other overseas versions of Crave have seen this.
Yes, I did. I think I mentioned this in passing last time. This was the one where if you were watching the trailer for this film, you saw someone or some outfit called Crave raving about it. Wherever they were based, they really loved it. I'll give you my view on it just a little bit later on. But you've been to some music as well in the last little while, Steve.
I've been to less music than I was planning to go to. But yes, I've seen a couple of very, very interesting acts. Steve Earle, who was a long-time favourite of mine, slightly less so after the concert, I have to tell you, but we'll discuss some more of that later. And also a Crave...
Okay. Any other?
A Crave favourite. Dare I say a Craverate? No, I don't say. That's Swamp Thing, played in Auckland recently, and they were fantastic, but then they always are.
Oh, good stuff. Yeah, I remember you raving about them in the past.
Oh, yeah.
And just quickly, there was someone you were hoping to see, but you didn't.
Yeah, Noel Gallagher. What a letdown. I'll have a few choice words about him later.
Okay, well, I can't wait. We shall start, though, with the Warner Brothers and the DC Comics attempt, I use that word advisedly, to rival the outlandishly popular series of Marvel superhero films. And we're talking here about Batman versus Superman, Dawn of Justice. So, there is a plot there. It's not going to be an easy one to sum up, Steve. I'm going to pass that to you.
Oh, you coward. You utter coward, Mercer.
Why you go?
Right, well, I mean, the story? Yeah, I gather there was one. You can imagine probably the pitch for this film was to be dead easy. You know, well, Batman sells millions of tickets. Superman sells millions of tickets. What will sell more tickets? Let's put them in a film together. And that really, to be fair, is about as far as the plot goes, I think, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, I guess they say versus one another, so you'd be right in thinking there's an element of fisticuffs at five paces. But what starts out as a rather serious altercation between these two superheroes, as the title tells you, it's the dawn of something else.
Yes.
Maybe that's all we need to say. I don't know.
Well, there is, to be fair, a little bit of an attempt at something meaningful and significant, and for the I think for the first hour and a half, Batman and Superman don't actually meet.
No.
Which is not to say their alter egos don't, but Batman and Superman don't actually encounter each other for about an hour and a half into the film. But what you do have is Bruce Wayne, who is convinced that Superman is a force that has no checks and balances on him, and you've got Clark Kent wanting to do a journalistic expo of Batman for the same reasons.
Exactly. Yeah.
And eventually they do get together. They fight rather perfunctorily for a couple of minutes and then kiss and make up, basically.
Yeah, yeah, and I think that's quite a big hurdle, plot hurdle to overcome, that they would actually go at each other for those reasons. But for the purposes of some dramatic tension, that's where they take the story. I just want to, very quickly, Steve, have you heard of a graphic artist, writer called Frank Miller?
Yeah, the name sounds familiar. Tell me more.
He was behind the Sin City graphic novels that were turned into films. So yes, he is also, he's what the guy who, I think it's back in the 80s, he rewrote the whole Batman story, and it was called The Dark Knight.
Yes.
And it was Batman, Bruce Wayne, as a much older person coming back out of retirement also to take up the cowl again. And I thought the first hour and a half that you've just been talking about, we were reintroduced to Steve Wayne, Steve McCabe, Bruce Wayne as Batman. This is Ben Affleck's take.
You see, this is what that film does to you. Just completely messes with your head badly.
But you know, I'm sure you noticed that Ben Affleck had flecks of grey in his the sides of his hair there.
Hard to notice, to be fair, because as you mentioned, you know, he's now the Dark Knight, and so all the Bruce Wayne scenes were filmed in darkness.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, it's true. It was a dark, gritty thing. But anyway, I thought the setting was as dark as the previous Christopher Nolan Batman films had been, the ones with Christian Bale. But I thought it was very much evoking that this guy Frank Miller's take on a slightly older Batman somehow. I think for those who'd followed the Batman story, that might have been one element that came through. But yes, dark, and dark also in lacking humour, I would say as well, Steve.
Oh, yeah, I mean, both Batman and Superman always spoke in very, very serious, deep, gruff voices all the way through. And there was not... The only levity there was to it was Jesse Eisenberg playing Lex Luthor and camping it up so far. It was just absurd and preposterous.
I agree. It was ridiculous at times.
But then you needed something to get over the intense darkness of everything else. You needed a little bit of light and shade.
You did.
But he played everything dialed up to 13.
He did. I thought Jeremy Irons had a few slightly wryly comic lines, as he, Jeremy Irons playing Alfred, the butler.
Oh, but there's a career that's gone to pot, hasn't it? I mean, you have to figure he was doing this for a very large sum of money because he was not doing this for the art. From Bride's Head to Gotham City. Now, there's a career arc you don't want to brag about. What's he become? No. But he was brilliant. He played this beautifully. His pitch was just right. Everybody else was either massively over the top or very dark and mumbly, and there was nothing in between except for Jeremy Irons, who was brilliant.
I agree. I thought he pitched it really, really well. But overall, you know, a few weeks ago we were talking about this outrageously, outlandishly funny superhero epic called Deadpool, which didn't take itself seriously. This was completely at the other end of the spectrum.
Absolutely. Incidentally, my daughter made a very good point. There is, when Batman versus Superman gets 2.5 hours and Deadpool gets 1.5, there is no justice in the world.
But less is more. Actually, just about that, Steve, I'm not sure what time of the day you went to see it. I actually ended up going during the day, and there were some parents there with some pretty young kids. I don't know, they looked like 8, 9, 10, 11, something around there. And I thought that the violence in this film was at times fairly nasty, fairly brutish.
Oh, yeah.
And I wondered whether those parents had second thoughts about bringing their young ones to it.
Yeah, I did see a few littlies, probably 7 or 8, at the 10 a.m. screening I went to. And I did see them walking out.
Did you? Yeah.
Yeah, clearly thinking, yeah, this you're too young for this. This is not really what's right for you. I mean, you know, as you say about Batman, these are children who never got to enjoy the high camp of Adam West many years ago. They know is the darkness of the Dark Knight, and it was too dark for kids of that age. I think it was a bit intense. It was also too long. It was boring.
It was very it was trying to tell the story of Batman versus Superman man, and also trying to merge the whole two different cinematic worlds of Gotham and Metropolis, and introducing Wonder Woman, and giving a bit of a taste of these other characters who would join the Justice League in future films. It was just trying to pack a lot in.
And at the same time, they still managed to find time to retell for the, I don't know how manyth time, the origin story of Batman. We know his parents got shot. Can we move on now, please?
They don't
need to get shot again and again and again and again. Although it did lead to one thing that I picked up on. This was my Catholic upbringing that had me this. If you remember very early on, there's a sequence where young Bruce Wayne is being lifted out of a cave.
Yes. Oh, yes. Yes. Almost.
Almost what? Where are you going to go with this?
Well, it was either some sort of dream type sequence or some. Well, it was a rising from the dead almost, wasn't it? It was that type of.
Exactly. And his arms outstretched as though in crucifixion. It's happening. And it struck me a few times later on that there were repeated references to. Do we even care about spoilers? Do you think anyone really gives. Yeah. A significant character does die. We think. And there were moments where when this one particular character was being tortured, where you see two other victims, one on the other side of him. And you're thinking, could that be a Calvary reference? Yeah. And you're thinking, maybe not. And then you realise later on when his body is being tended to after he has died.
Yes.
It's very definitely a crucifixion scene where the body's been taken down from the cross. And you can actually see in the background there are crosses on a hill behind this scene as he's being tended to. It is so obviously a Christian resurrection imagery that's going on.
Yeah. Fascinating. I didn't pick that as easily as you. I'm going to throw a little spanner
in the
works.
That's the joys of a Catholic education. Yeah, for you, Simon.
I'm going to throw a little spanner in our sort of general agreement on this. I'm going to say, actually, for all that we've just said, Steve, and I agree with the criticisms that can be levelled at this film, my expectations going in were pretty low.
Were they met?
Well, I actually thought it was a little better than I thought it might have been. I know that might sound odd after all I've said, but I actually, if you had been following the previous, you know, individual Superman and Batman films, and you knew that the DC crowd were trying to take on Marvel, there's an element of curiosity just to see how the heck they try to pull it off.
Yeah, and how do you reconcile these two totally disparate worlds?
Yeah, and I sort of. At times, I felt it was bloody grim and taking itself too seriously, long, dark, violent. But if you are into superhero movies and if you have a bit of a history with these characters, I would still say it's probably worth having a look at it. I wouldn't completely dismiss it because it is an attempt to set the stage for a whole new range of films to come.
You make a good point, though, when you talk about the
curiosity,
whole setup.
Curiosity factor there.
You said the setting up of the
it's new, a franchise, isn't it?
Certainly, a new franchise. Let's be absolutely fair, except for possibly in the big finale. Did you even need Wonder Woman in this film, or were they simply putting her in there to sow the seed, set up the franchise as you put it? Is she entirely narratively necessary?
I think she is only fulfilling that purpose as a setup for things to come. I think they
could have dispensed with her, to be fair.
Could have. Yeah.
I mean, I think it's very telling, to be honest. At the very beginning, when the opening credits are appearing on the screen, and you've got all the production company credits, I don't know if you picked up on this, but one of them is actually said, a cruel and unusual production.
I'd have missed that.
I thought, oh dear Lord, that just sets the tone for the next 2.5 hours, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Now, I have a confession to make with this film, to be fair. I wasn't in the absolutely ideal frame of mind to see it. I was in utter agony from a slip disc watching it. And I'm not completely convinced that my pain was entirely down to the fact that I had a nerve being compressed in the small of my back. I think a lot of the pain was emotional.
Okay.
I think the pain was coming from watching Batman versus bloody Superman, seriously.
Fair enough. The
thing that really hurts is... I saw this, and as a result, I wasn't able, because I've been horizontal for the next several days, I didn't get to see The Hunt for the Wilder People.
Ah.
And I can't help but feel that maybe I saw the wrong film.
I think you might be right. I did see Hunt for the Wilder People, I think is how they say it in the movie.
I didn't even get to see it.
Yeah, right. I'll tell you a little bit about it. Lots been said about it. So this is the new film from Taika Waititi. He's a writer and a director. It's the story, it's based on a written story by a very famous archetypal New Zealand man of the bush you may have heard of, Steve. It's going back a few years now, called Barry Crump. Does that name resonate with you at all?
6 years, mate. 6 years. I'm technically a Kiwi now.
Oh, I must remember that.
You do. Yeah, I know the accent might possibly catch you out there, but, you know, notionally, I am one of you.
All right, lovely. So this is a story, a comic story about a young Maori lad called Ricky. He's probably about 12 or 13, played by a very engaging young man called Julian Dennison. He's taken to a farm by the authorities to be straightened out by a couple of farmers called Heck, who's played by Sam Neill, and Bella, who's played by Rima Te Wiata. They live in a remote farm. They want to set him on the road of good, decent living. And basically, it's what happens when Ricky and Heck take to the land for a couple of reasons. They're hunted by the authorities, and it's this madcap escapade which ensues. I laughed a lot. Most of the people in the cinema laughed a lot. It's Steve, I don't know if you had a chance to go back and look in your time here, it's ever catch some of the seminal films of the 70s and 80s in this country. There were a group of them, starting with Sleeping Dogs, and there were others like Smash Palace, Vigil, Goodbye Pork Pie, that's just a few. More recently, of course, Lord of the Rings. And this film, quite deliberately, I think, pays respect and touches on scenes and imagery from those earlier films in telling this new story about a couple of people on the run, out in the bush, hunted by the authorities. It's a classic Kiwi sort of setting for a film, and Taika Waititi, the director, really does a wonderful job showing you the New Zealand bush. It looks fantastic. And I just mentioned Barry Crump. He and a character called Scotty, Steve, were famous in New Zealand in the 70s. They starred in a very, very popular campaign of TV ads for Toyota trucks.
Oh, yeah?
And this film absolutely nails that image again. There's a lot of good comic work from actors like Oscar Keitley and Rachel House. Rhys Darby, he plays this loony conspiratorial bushman. Even Stan Walker from New Zealand Idol fame turns up and does quite a nice turn as well. Rima Te Wiata is really, really does a lovely turn as the wife. The comedy veers from absolute straight-out slapstick to more subtle, sort of clever scripting. Occasionally, the comedy was a little forced for me. I did cringe a little bit, but not too much. The story didn't probably have a lot of surprises, but it didn't matter. And what really mattered most, of course, was with the young boy, with young Ricky, and the old bushman, Heck, Sam Neill, would they click in terms of an on-screen relationship? I thought they did really, really well. Sam Neill can do it effortlessly. He's been around a while. Julian Dennison, as a young lad, he had a verve and a humour. He had some nice timing, very likeable. Steve, if you haven't had a chance, if your back is up to sitting down and, sitting in a cinema seat again, please go see this film.
Well, I have to say, I saw the trailer and I thought, this is going to be joyful.
It has a nice few little, whimsical touches, a little bit of commentary on young people fitting in and how we look after them, that sort of thing. But most of the time, yeah, it's just a lovely celebration of kind of a slightly dated now vision of New Zealanders, the bushmen and but it works really, really well. I think people overseas would really like it. I think so. It shows the country to good effect.
Well, I know I had a quick look on IMDb at the filming locations. Yeah. There is one filming location mentioned.
I actually didn't see it. I'm assuming it was the Uruweras.
According to IMDb, it's New Zealand.
Okay.
Now, listen, here's the thing. Casting your mind back many, 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 many months to when we first started doing this thing of ours.
Yes.
We occasionally did a thing of trying to tie together two extraordinarily disparate films that we'd looked at. And we came up with some contrived...
Yes.
Connection. So here's your challenge. How are you going to pull together a connection between Batman versus Superman, Yawn of Justice on the one hand, and Hunt for the Wilder People on the other? Go.
Right. Stand by. Well, Dawn of Justice, of course, is the rival company to Marvel, and they're trying to build, as we just said, a sort of a universe of cinematic characters and films which would rival the Marvel cinematic universe. And one of the upcoming films in the Marvel cinematic universe is another of the Thor films. I think it's slated for next year. It's called Thor Ragnarok. And the man Marvel have tapped on the shoulder to direct Thor Ragnarok is the director of Hunt for the Wilder People, Taika Waititi.
Effortless.
Ta-da! Effortless.
Done like a pro, mate. Seriously. Were I wearing a hat, it would be off to you by now.
Ah, well.
So, incidentally, yeah. You say this is in the Thor series. What number is it, do you know?
It would be the third Thor film.
Oh, it's a shame. I was hoping it would be number four.
Yes.
You'd ask for videos. I'd like tickets for Thor 4, please. Really? I saw Thor 4 last week. And you could have fun with it, couldn't you?
You could. Yeah, Thor 3 doesn't quite...
Thor 3, no, it's a bugger to say.
Yeah, I'm Thor, but not complaining.
Oh, very good. Very, very good. Nice.
All right, look, I've rambled on about blimmin' movies, but this is a. If you haven't seen it, I really would recommend Hunt for the Wilder People.
You've sold it on me, mate.
All right, lovely.
Definitely going.
Now, we should mention some music, I think, and I'd like to pass the baton, the cultural baton, to you. And,
okay.
I'd like to hear a bit about Steve Earle, for one thing, because I don't know him intimately, but the songs I do know of him, I kind of like what he does. Although he's been around for a long time now, hasn't he?
See, that's basically my level of familiarity with him, to be honest. I remember. Well, give me a song that you remember, see if you come up with the same one that I did.
Well, there's only one that I really, really know, which is Copperhead Road.
Of course. And I remember I was driving up there, I was thinking, you know, he better play that, so there's no way he can't. And out of about a 20-song set, I think that was about number 7.
Oh, okay.
I was expecting it to be an encore, but he played it. Yeah. And at the end of it, he made a comment about, he said, okay, so all of those of you with probation and curfews, you can go home now.
Did he? Which,
yeah, exactly. So he shows what he thinks of his audience. Oh. But I have to tell you, you know, we often in add into the edit for this show, we'll add little recordings of concerts.
Yes.
Guess what song I will not be adding?
Ah, really?
Oh, it was bad.
Oh, what a shame.
It was really bad. I mean, remember, Copperhead Road came out nearly 30 years ago. Let's not forget, this is an... Oh, he's aged.
Yeah.
And his voice has got a lot gruffer since then. It really has. He didn't even attempt to sing it. He sort of droned his way through it. It was a painful experience for what is fantastically and incredibly powerful song.
Very powerful.
It's an amazing song. It's a fantastic story it tells.
Yeah.
If you remember, that it's underpinned by kind of like the drone of a... Well, I can't think what instrument it would be. So some sort of pipe.
Yes, yeah.
That's all you could hear.
Yeah, absolutely.
You could on stage, you could just about make out the mandolin that he was playing, but otherwise, all you could really hear was that drone, the chant.
Oh, what a shame.
It was an awful shame. It really was. His voice wasn't up for it. And you could tell that's what people were looking for. Because as soon as he started playing it, and people knew, he strapped the mandolin on, they knew it was coming. And suddenly, all the cell phones came out because people were videoing it.
Yeah.
And by the end of the song, most of them have been put away again because people realise that this was not a particularly brilliant reading of the song.
Okay. What about some of the other songs? Did he do better elsewhere?
Well, that's the thing. He was touring his new album, Terraplane Blues, which is... it was touted when it came out this time last year as his first ever blues album. And I'd say everything he's ever done is blues, to be honest. But it was very, very rich and bluesy in places. And it's an album of music that he is playing now. So now his voice, rough and haggard though it is, now suits those songs.
Right.
And he knocked those out of the park. They were brilliant. And one of those will be what we will transition with at the end of this review. They were vastly superior. What we had to begin with... disappointing, which was a shame, really. But interestingly, he originally was meant to be playing the Power Station. No, not the Power Station, the studio, I beg your pardon.
Right.
He was supposed to be playing the studio in Auckland. And as far as I can make out, it was lack of ticket sales. They switched him to the Tuning Fork, which is a much smaller venue. But it did give a lovely intimacy to the show. He and a band of four on stage really played a very, very agreeable show. Like I say, were it not for Copperhead Road being absolutely destroyed, I would have been raving about it.
Maybe it's just because he's played Copperhead Road about 1,000,001 times, I suspect.
Well, that one snarky comment that he made does actually feed into that theory, doesn't it?
Yeah. And I can slip in a little Springsteen reference here.
Of course you can.
Of course I can. He has in the past played a fair bit of Springsteen, especially Springsteen's famous acoustic album, Nebraska.
Right. That would seem... There'd be a good crossover there, wouldn't there?
Yeah, he's played Nebraska. He's played State Trooper from that album. They're not weren't bad, actually. Swamp Thing,
I saw a couple of times last year and found to be one of the most engaging live presences I've seen in a very long time. They were at the King's Arms last week, and I was able to see them because Noel Gallagher cancelled.
What was the reason for his cancellation?
The official reason that we got at lunchtime on the day we were supposed to be playing was if you remember, there's a little bit of bad weather in Auckland.
I do recall that.
Supposedly an apocalyptic storm of biblical proportions. And the flight that his kit was on from South America couldn't make it into Auckland in time for the show.
Ah, okay.
And apparently he then had a really packed schedule in Australia and the UK immediately afterwards, which meant that he couldn't reschedule for after his Australian tour, and so he just flagged Auckland.
Dismissive.
Soft southern bugger. Yeah. So he flagged it, which suddenly meant I was free that same evening to go up to the King's Arms and see Swamp Thing. And I was awfully glad I did. They're always worth seeing. They're a fantastic band. Two men on stage, one on drums, one on guitar, and yet you'd think it was a full rock band playing. And in particular, you can't mention Swamp Thing without a quick reference to Michael Barker. The man's the most phenomenal drummer you'll ever see. Where he keeps those extra limbs that he must be using for that kind of percussion, I don't know. Absolutely fantastic.
So can I just ask you, having seen them the number of times you have, does the set tend to change much over the times you've seen them?
It varies a little bit. There's a few favourites in there. Voodoo Doll remains one of their classics. They've got very little actual recorded output. Most of it's stuff that they've performed on stage and then recorded as live albums. Yeah. It's a fairly straightforward template they cleave to, but it works.
Good start.
I'd also like to mention in passing, their support act was a young Australian woman by the name of Minnie Marks. I'd never heard of before. Awfully glad I've heard of her now. One woman with a guitar and a box for a kick drum. Sounds a bit basic. It was raw, it was harsh, it was very, very good. She can play guitar and she can howl the blues.
Oh, lovely. Minnie Marks,
definitely worth a look.
If you just joined the podcast, I don't think you can do that with podcasts. You can do that with radio stations. Well,
You might have walked. You might have walked into the room while somebody else was listening.
Yes. So if you have,
people don't tune in anymore, do they?
No, they don't.
No one's going down the dial looking.
No. But this is Crave.
Yes,
this
it is. Yes, I'm getting in the way of your link there, aren't I?
No. So the other guy is Steve McCabe, and I'm Simon Mercer, and we get together and talk about music and movies and other things every now and then. And we've got a website.
Speaking of other things,
yes.
Yes. Tell us about other things.
Yes, I shall. Well, here's a question to you, Mr. McCabe. Do your pulses start to race if I were to throw names at you like Pontiac, Chevrolet, Oldsmobile, Studebaker, Mustang, Buick, DeSoto, etc., etc.?
No.
Oh, in that case, it's a good thing.
It's a good thing you were the one who saw these things, isn't it?
And you were not at Whangamataara over the last couple of days, where they had their annual Beach Hop, which is this big, big gathering of classic car aficionados. And they bring their cars, their caravans, their motorbikes, their 1950s fashion collections. This is a town, I think the resident population, Steve, is, 2 or 3,000, something like that. Any summertime, it grows. But apparently, during this particular weekend, it gets to the tens of thousands. And I have to say, I don't at all consider myself a petrol head, not even close. But the style of these cars, I really found them incredibly impressive and attractive. That the restoration and the care that goes into them is obvious. And I think it's just whenever you get any group of people together and they've got a common passion, that enthusiasm, it's very hard for it not to be infectious. And
yes.
I just kind of got caught up in the sweep. I knocked off some photos of some of the cars. I'll put them on the website to see what you think. I thought it was quite an interesting event. And there was some music, I have to say.
Oh, now you're talking my language.
Okay. So, as I said, this is not music setting any new boundaries here. This is music from yesteryear. There are selection of bands playing 50s and 60s rock, rock and roll, country rock, rockabilly type material.
So it's nothing terribly remarkable and exciting, but
not in that sense, no.
But completely in fitting with all the vehicular brands you mentioned.
Yeah. And on the Saturday night, we went to the Whangamataara Club, and they were playing some rock and roll. When we got there, we just caught the end of a set from a performer who has been on the New Zealand music scene since the 60s. She was one of a pair of sisters called the Chicks, very non-sexist name. This is Suzanne Donaldson. She's often appeared over the years in her own right or backing other bands. And her place in pop history, I didn't know this, but in her last song, she said, look, when we were together in the 60s, we recorded this next song, and we released it 6 months before the most famous version was released. The song was most well known because it came from Ike and Tina Turner.
Oh, yeah?
It's River Deep, Mountain High.
Oh, wow.
And they had, I would never have thought such a thing. That's no. Suzanne, the Chicks in New Zealand recorded it before Ike and Tina Turner did.
And did they do it justice?
Her voice is good. Her voice, and it was a slightly... this is a Saturday night in a country town. It was a good band, but it wasn't a full out production. But her voice is good, and I enjoyed the take on it. And she was followed by another New Zealand icon. You may have heard of this guy, Eddie Lowe.
The name does sound familiar. Yes,
he's also been around for decades. He wears slightly, his glasses are a little dark, as Roy Orbison's were, Steve, and I think he very much pitched himself as our version of Roy Orbison.
Okay.
His voice, he had and has a lovely voice, and he would attack some songs and try and emulate that Orbison, that vocal style, which is very hard to do. But anyway, he also had a playing some old rock and roll, ran through very quickly a selection of classics, nothing surprising, 50s and 60s songs. Black shirt, black pants, big, large, shimmering belt buckle.
there's a very definite image being aped there, isn't there?
There is. But look, I had never seen him live, and I thought, hey, there's nothing surprising here, but you can still do it, you know. And the thing I thought with both these artists was, they don't have to do it. Their place in New Zealand musical history is secure. They're not playing in front of a huge audience, but they just love it. They still like it, and what the hell, let them go for it. There's an audience. There are some people who love to hear that stuff. They do it professionally with a degree of passion. Who are we to get in their way? Go for it, I say. And I'll just quickly mention one other group I caught a little bit of the next day, an Aussie group from Newcastle in Australia call the Flat Trackers.
The Flat Trackers, no.
Yeah, that's a good name. A three-piece, rockabilly, standing double bass, very good drummer, and a vocalist and guitarist doing that sort of pretty raw rockabilly, pretty good stuff. I thought they would be worth seeing if you ever wanted to tap your feet and have a bit of a dance on the dance floor. The Flat Trackers would do the business for you.
Name to look out for.
All right. There you
excellent.
Are.
It's been quite a week, hasn't it?
Oh, I've had to have a cup of tea and a lie down.
Steady on.
Yeah, I know. Nothing in the tea. And I think, Mr. McCabe, we should just look ahead a little bit. I'm going to be overseas, actually in Australia, in the next week or so. So I might try and do my best to sample some cultural offerings and report back next time. But if for you who are staying here in this fair land, what's coming up here?
Oh, there's some busy stuff coming up very, very shortly. We've got some crackers coming actually in the near future. Next week we've got previews of The Huntsman. I don't know if you're familiar with this one. The full title is The Huntsman Winter's War.
Yes, I think this is the second Huntsman film, I think.
Yes, I think it falls on from Snow White and.
Yeah, exactly.
So I don't know when you have the second one, where it fits into the whole sequel prequel kind of structure. It's like an interquel, shall we go with?
So this is Charlize Theron and Chris Hemsworth and all that lot.
Absolutely, that's what. Yeah,
looks pretty good.
Emily Blunt's in it. Jessica Chastain. I mean, there's some top names. Nick Frost, Colin Morgan. This has got Rob Brydon's in it. Excellent. This has got quality written all over it. So that one should be really good. So I'll be seeing that on tomorrow.
Oh, good. Excellent.
Excellent. We've also got the new Melissa McCarthy vehicle, The Boss.
Oh, she's taking Springsteen on, is she?
I think she plays him, yes.
Yeah. Oh, someone has to.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. Yep.
This is Melissa McCarthy, as the synopsis says, a titan of industry is sent to prison after she's caught for insider trading. Wow. So, no, not actually Bruce Springsteen, I don't think.
No.
Bit of a stretch there. So we've got those two coming up. Then the following week, and if you're going to be in Australia, you're going to miss the screening for this that looks absolutely fantastic. Is the new Tina Fey film, Whiskey Tango Foxtrot.
Okay, yeah. Tina Fey, she's pretty hot at the moment, isn't she?
She's absolutely brilliant. It's also got Margot Robbie in it. So last time I saw Margot Robbie, she was in a bubble bath in The Big Short.
Okay.
And even better than that, I mean, what could be better than Tina Fey and Margot Robbie, I hear you ask? I'll tell you what's better than that.
Yes.
Martin Freeman.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, he of many of Sherlock and Bilbo Baggins and all that lot.
The very fellow.
Yes.
I don't know if you know anything about this film.
Not much.
It's
Whiskey
Tango Foxtrot. It's Tina Fey plays a news journalist, much like yourself, who decides for whatever reason that she's going to go off and cover the war in Afghanistan.
Uh-huh.
What could possibly go wrong?
I did not.
So that's getting previewed while you're in Australia, I'm afraid. So I'll tell you all about it when you get back.
Lovely.
So that's what's looking good in the way of films. Music's looking kind of exciting over the next week or so as well, actually, to be honest.
Okay, please fill me in.
Well, we've got next, let's think, on the 13th, do you remember The Stranglers?
I do.
Dun, dun, dun. Dun, dun, dun,
dun. That one?
The very fella, yes.
Yes.
They will be strangling. Oh dear, I can't believe I did that. At the Power Station on the 13th.
Yeah.
On the 15th, you got a couple of choices on the 15th. You got Holly Smith playing at the Power Station. You got Anthony Stretch playing at the Golden Dawn. But the big event on Friday the 15th of this month is going to be Waiting in the Sky, the Bowie tribute.
Ah, that we previewed the other week, yeah.
Exactly, that's coming around. And that's going to be on the 15th at the ASB Theatre in Auckland. They're also going to be taking that one around the country. They're doing Wellington and Christchurch as well. Details on the website, of course.
Yeah.
So that one's worth checking out. And then...
Oh, did you just hear something off on the side?
I have no idea what that could possibly be.
It's a phone.
I thought maybe that was some of the music that we're previewing.
Don't worry, it'll stop in a second.
You don't do this when you're on telly, do you, mate? Come on.
No, that's true.
No, you're more professional when you're on telly. You just
exactly,
lower your standards for Crave, don't you?
Oh, dear.
Very, very disappointed.
But it's live and as it happened, you know?
Oh, yeah, we'll take that. Yeah, we'll
anyway,
take that.
Can I just mention, I think Holly Smith has either just or is just about to put out a new album, I think.
That's the one, yes.
Yeah, yeah, so that'll be... might quite have a listen to that. Oh, there's a lot to talk about next time.
There is indeed. In fact, there's one more that's worth mentioning. 21 yeah. Pilots.
Okay.
This is odd name for an American rap R&B rock duo, but they're called 21 Pilots. This is one of the joys of having a teenage daughter, you see, so that's how I find out about bands like this. They were meant to play the Logan Campbell Centre in Auckland, but the tickets sold so fast they got switched to the Vector Arena.
Ah, lovely.
And they will be playing on the 18th, on Monday the 18th. Okay. Still tickets available, I believe, for that one, so it's definitely worth a look.
All right, because I remember you very kindly managed to get me in to see Hozier last year. And
yes.
Didn't know so much about him, and I thought he was fantastic. So it's nice to be pleasantly surprised, and I wonder whether that would apply to 21 Pilots. I suspect it may very well.
We shall. I'll let you know. And then, of course, the other big one, just to tee it up, because it's coming soon, at the the end of the month. It's actually next month now, isn't it? On the 1st of May, we've actually got Iron Maiden coming to... to Auckland and indeed Christchurch, I think, a couple of days before. So, and Black Sabbath are playing next month. Everyone's coming, mate. Everyone's coming.
We're just a mecca for music here.
It's a wonderful time to be alive.
Ah, lovely. Okay, well, look, I think we've...
overstayed our welcome?
Well, I hope we haven't, but we've given our listeners all...
both of them. Yeah.
Lots to think about. Anyway, so, hey, this has been Crave. Nice to have a chat to you guys about what we've been listening to. If you want to get in touch with us, please email us podcast@cravepodcast.com.
We're on Facebook, as all the cool kids are. You can also find us on Twitter @cravepodcast.
Lovely. I'm Simon Mercer.
I'm Steve McKay.
And that's what's been entertaining us this week.
So it's good night from me.
And it's good night from him.
Good night.